achieving a stabilized landing approach, and what to do when you can't land on a runway, I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest today is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot, which you can read online. Bob is a flight instructor based in the Buffalo, New York area, has some sometimes controversial views on flight training. We get together on Monday to have what we hope will be thought-provoking conversations on flight training and on safety in general for aviation. Bob, thanks for taking a few minutes out for our listeners today.
Good morning, Paul.
Let me ask you about a couple of things that were in the April edition of Over the Airwaves. First of all, you were back on the topic of stabilized approaches as an important issue in terms of proper landings. This seems so intuitive, you almost wonder why people would have to write about it, but I would assume that you see things in the accident reports that suggest that this is still something people miss.
Well, there's an old adage that most of us veteran pilots are aware of, and that is a stabilized approach is a key to a good landing. And oftentimes with new or inexperienced pilots, we see a rather haphazard approach and then a lot of effort to stabilize the airplane just over the numbers in order to configure for landing. When in fact, if they did that stabilization, say on the downwind leg, got their speed under control, their altitude under control, heading under control, landing configuration, say 10 degrees of flaps, and then just simply go through the pattern in a sequential fashion, slightly reducing power, adding flaps, and then getting stabilized on the final approach course, the airplane, in theory, will literally land itself.
Bob, I have to throw in here that one of the habits my primary flight instructor had to break me of during flight training for the private certificate was, you know, we were practicing frequently at a small airport, the same small airport, and I kind of got in the habit of using landmarks specific to that airport to define the pattern. You know, pull throttle at the fuel truck and make my downwind to base turn when I'm over the pond and that sort of thing. I think you're talking more about abstract points that could be in relationship to any pattern. Run us through exactly what this process might be in a typical airplane.
Well, naturally, and the point that you make is a good one. Every airport landmark, of course, is different. But let's just assume a traditional traffic pattern, regardless of the airport. And let's assume also that this is a non-towered airport where ATC or the tower is not vectoring us around. A typical non-towered airport, we would be on the downwind leg, 1,000 feet above the ground. That would be pattern altitude. Now, using a Cessna 172 or a Piper Arrow, or a Piper Archer or any of the training class airplanes, even a Cessna 152, let's put together some numbers to see how this works. We'll dial back our power to 2,200 RPM and pitch for 90 knots, flaps up. And this is on the downwind. As we come abeam the end of the runway that we're going to be landing on, I generally have my students pull the power very slowly off 300 RPM. So now we're down to 1900 RPM. We slight pitch forward, 10 degrees of flaps. Now the airplane should be cruising along at 80 knots, descending at about 500 to 600 feet per minute. Mm-hmm. A left turn to base, power remains the same, second notch of flaps or 20 degree of flaps, and the power, and the airspeed then slowly drifts down to 70 knots. A turn to final, third notch of flaps, power to 1300 RPM, speed settles down to 65 to 60 knots. That's all there is to it. And then once over the runway threshold, a very gentle flare, power to idle, and the airplane wheel should just kiss the runway. Now notice in my commentary, we had the speed under control out at the downwind leg, 90, 80 on base, 70 on final, 60, 65 over the numbers, and it works every time. Now if the speed is not under control, and let's suppose we turn final a bit high and we're doing 95 knots, now there's a struggle to get the airplane configured for landing. And that's where, my experience, we find most pilots having difficulty with their landing. They're just not configured for it prior to running across atop the runway threshold.
Well, and I guess this will vary somewhat, too. If you're at a strange airport, obviously it's probably going to be easier to find yourself in this too high, too fast circumstance. And I guess at that point, the one thing that's always bothered me a little bit was the coordination of getting that under control once I was already over the runway. In other words, if I find myself coming into, say, Klamath Falls, Oregon, which has a 10,000-foot runway, I'm not going to do a go-around if I'm a little too high when I get over the numbers, because that would just be wasteful. But at the same time, once I see that pavement under me, it tends to skew my perception a little bit, and I'm not sure that I'm really adept at getting 95 knots and too high down to 60 knots and just right, you know, over the runway.
Well, this is the advantage of training at a small, short field runway, because everything has to be right every time. The example that you use, training at 150-foot wide, 5,000 or 8,000-foot long runway, these skills can not be developed. We become sloppy because, of course, we have all kinds of runway to work with. So if you're based at a large airport with a long and wide runway, get over to, a non-towered field where the runway is, 75 feet wide and 2,800 feet long, and those skills will be, believe me, masterfully developed. There is an exercise, by the way, Paul, that works very nicely to demonstrate the importance of a stabilized landing or the benefit of it. Just fly up to a safe altitude, say 4,000 feet, and pick an imaginary altitude slightly below that, say 3,700 feet. And at 4,000 feet, we're going to begin powering back and imagine landing at that 3,700-foot altitude point. And we basically slow the airplane up at 4,000 feet. We begin slowly to configure it for landing and then allow the airplane to be descending no faster than 200 feet per minute at 60 knots, just as you pass through your target altitude of 3,700 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, repeated practices of this, and we can begin to see just how easy it is to land an airplane if we have things stabilized on the approach. In fact, this technique can be used in the highly unlikely event that we have a jammed control. We can just trim the airplane, use power to assess or to determine our descent rate, and then we can land just using power and rudder to keep the wings level and power to descend, and again we could hit that target altitude at just 200, maybe 300 feet per minute. Once we have that under control, then landings are really a piece of cake.
You did mention something else too that is something I always kind of chuckle at, but it could be deadly, and that is that some people tend to fly patterns way too big at these small airports and small aircraft. You call them airliner patterns. I've actually heard people joke on CTAF frequencies when somebody in a 152 was a mile from the runway on downwind. It occurs to me that one of the reasons traffic patterns were created the way they were is so that you have a chance to do this stabilization. And if you get down to the point where you're 1,000 feet above the ground, a mile from the runway, you have defeated the purpose of the pattern, because now if something goes wrong, you cannot make the runway.
Well, yes, that's right. You've not only defeated the purpose, you've created a very dangerous situation. And we see this in our area a lot. We have a flight school that operates out of a big, large airport, and oftentimes no fault of their own over there. Tower is sequencing the arrivals into the runway, and sometimes spacing is such that they have to create big, long downwinds in order to make this happen. Those big, long downwinds, however, are sometimes brought over to the small, non-towered field. And as a result, we see an individual, they're on a downwind, and they continue a mile or 2 miles beyond the airport before turning base. Now, the FAR aim, unfortunately, is not too terribly specific on the design of airport traffic patterns. They give recommendations. But they do give a recommendation that turn to base should be done no more than 1/4 mile from the end of the runway. And when that happens, the runway, the traffic pattern remains in close. The sequence of airplanes, we can move them into the airport environment a bit faster. But when you get that big, long airliner approach where he's out a mile before turning base, the temptation for the guy behind him is to either follow him out a mile and sometimes even a bit further, or cut in front.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have an individual who's basically stepping out of line on the downwind, turning a normal base when the guy in front of him is extending it out further. And you can see the headaches that result. I have oftentimes used the example with my students, at any point in the traffic pattern, if the engine should fail, it would be a tough explanation to the insurance company or to the owner of the aircraft or to yourself, actually, why you did not successfully make the runway without the engine. Mm-hmm. And, of course, if you're a mile out, you're not going to make the runway.
Right. Bob, we're up on our break, but when we come back, you also wrote in the April edition about some of the factors that go into decision-making when it comes time to choose whether to make an emergency landing off airport or whether to try to make it to the airport runway. I want to talk about that when we come back. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. We'll be back in a moment on the Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Platt.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Waas GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend.
Chérie, viens près moi.
But our other guy, the pilot without Waas, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Waas GPS. Follow the leader.
Chérie.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Platt, talking today as we do each Monday with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. And Bob, you wrote about something in the April edition that took me back to my check ride. I was up with my examiner, and at the point where she pulled the throttle to simulate an engine out and see how I'd handle it, I immediately headed for a field that was in plain view, straight ahead, into the wind, smooth, all the things you'd want in an emergency landing site. And when it appeared I'd committed to it, she tapped me on the shoulder and pointed down, and I looked down, and there was an airport directly under me. And it was a half-paved, half-grass-strip airport. It would have been a crosswind landing. And I said to her, being as assertive as I felt I could be on a check ride, that, you know what? I'm set up for this landing, and it's a great place to land, and everything's right. I'm going to go through with it anyway. We ended up taking it down to just a couple hundred feet, and she agreed that it would have been a successful landing, and we added power and continued on with the check ride. But when these decisions happen in real life, Bob, pilots make the wrong choice often. And you wrote about an anecdote where somebody decided to try to make the runway rather than put it down in some unimproved area, and it turned out to be a fatal mistake. What does our thought process need to be to come out of one of these situations intact?
Well, unfortunately, Paul, this happens in far too many cases, and I don't know whether it's the natural instinct to save the airplane versus save our souls, but if an airport, of course, is an ideal place to put an airplane down. So we look out there, and we may see 1 to 2 or 3 miles, or depending on our altitude, a stretch to get there, and the overwhelming temptation is to do just that, when in fact right below us or in between may be that agricultural field that you referred to, or even a highway that would make a much better approach, or a much more high probability, I should say, of reaching that and making a satisfactory landing. Again, without deference to the insurance companies, once that engine fails in flight, the airplane, for all intents and purposes, belongs to the insurance company. That's what I tell myself. That's what I tell my students. And even the insurance company would much rather have us come out uninjured with a seriously damaged airplane as opposed to come out of the event fatal in an attempt to reach the airport. But again, now I think you alluded to this. We are a test pilot at that point. You know, if we go for the field, that field could be extremely soft, and it might result in a, you know, flipping over the airplane once it touches the ground. Or if we try a highway, there may be power lines along the way. But I lost a good friend here in Buffalo several years ago flying a Navajo with an engine failure and then a second engine failure. And a lot of maneuvering took place in an attempt, we gathered, to perhaps reach the airport, when all around there were alfalfa fields, which is just a, you know, 6-inch high crop that he could have set down without injury. And unfortunately, he died in the event. And as I reported in Over the Airwaves, there was a Cessna 210 that was high up when he lost his engine. but did not manage to descend close enough to the airport to reach it on final, and he met his demise on the way in. So the message is simple. You know, if it's obstacle free, and you can put it down, do that rather than to try and stretch it to the airport.
Is there anything we can do to prepare for this kind of landing? I mean, this is something obviously for insurance and common sense reasons we don't practice on a regular basis with a rented training aircraft.
Well, I've seen, yes, there is something that we can do. I've seen time and time and time again where an examiner will say to the candidate, okay, the engine has failed. Pick out a spot and show me what you can do. And the student invariably points straight ahead or to the side, maybe a mile out, a half a mile out, when ideally the best landing spot could be directly underneath the airplane. Look straight down, start the airplane in a turn. And what can we do to practice this? Get up over an airport. Declare your intentions, simulate an engine out, and dead stick, no power. See if you can do a descending spiral and hit the airport every time. I would much rather deal with suitable landing areas directly underneath me as opposed to questioning whether or not I can make a somewhat distant airport given the fact that we have winds that may influence. Another important aspect of this is it's not covered in the PTS, it's not covered in the private or instrument pilot syllabus, but that is the possibility of an engine failure in the clouds or above the clouds, where we can set up a glide speed and then glide on top of an airport that is revealed to us solely by the moving map on our GPS. So we put the airplane directly directly over an airport that we cannot see out the window, but by the GPS, of course, we can see it, and we do a fairly steep descending spiral through the clouds with the objective of breaking out of the clouds somewhere above pattern altitude and then effecting a safe landing. This is something that every instrument pilot should be practicing at least once or twice every couple of months, and that is that emergency descent through the clouds to a runway below, breaking out, and then landing safely on the runway.
Well, Bob, at least we did confirm a couple weeks ago at Lakeland that a 210 can taxi through mud without flipping over.
Well, we'll save that story for another time.
All right. Well, Bob, we'll talk to you again next Monday.
Thanks, Paul.
I don't want to get out this week without reminding you, if you find anything you want to comment on in this week's discussion with Bob, make sure to send me an email, Paul P, that's P-A-U-L-P, at aero-news.net. My guest has been Bob Miller of Bob Miller Flight Instruction Incorporated and Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot, and you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.